ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if the most ordinary things in your life aren't ordinary at all? A toothbrush, the pockets in your jeans, even a gravestone. Someone designed them, shaped them, argued over them, and got it so right, you've stopped noticing. The everyday is full of hidden ingenuity, and on By Design with me, Anthony Burke, we pull it all into the light. Search for By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Has the Iran war got you thinking about changing to an electric vehicle? Did government subsidies help you go solar or install a home battery? Or has the struggle to put food on the table in a cost of living crisis made climate change really the least of your worries right now? Today on Big Ideas, the importance of making the energy transition make economic sense for Middle Australia. Former MP and journalist Zoe Daniel puts the questions to Tom Woodroof on the hip pocket politics of climate change.
Vast swathes of Australia are doing everything they can as part of this transition, right? And this was really brought home to me by someone who said to me at the time that they had got solar on their roof, they'd installed a battery, had a hybrid, couldn't afford an EV, but was crawling into bed at night to save money on the power that they were getting from the grid. And I thought, wow, that's a really great demonstration of how so many people are doing everything they can to embrace this transformation when it can stack up economically for them.
Yes, the battle for hearts and minds so often begins with the household budget, doesn't it? A senior international fellow with the Smart Energy Council, Tom Woodroof, is author of Power, Prosperity and Planet, Climate and Energy Policy for All. That's one of Monash University Publishing's In the National Interest book series. And hello, Natasha Mitchell, bringing you Big Ideas, our live event show here on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. It's great to have your ears. Tom was a key negotiator for the Marshall Islands during the landmark Paris Agreement on climate change. He served as a principal advisor and chief of staff to Kevin Rudd during the former Prime Minister's tenure as Australia's ambassador to the US and president of the Asia Society in New York. He joins you from this Readings Bookshop event on Wurundjeri country with former community-backed independent MP for the Melbourne seat of Goldstein and former ABC foreign correspondent Zoe Daniel.
It really is my pleasure to be here with Tom Woodroof. Tom has an extraordinary history for someone who is very fair and young from my point of view. It's amazing to consider, isn't it, that Tom played such a substantive role in the Paris Agreement in 2015. Were you about 15 at the time, Tom?
I think 26, if I've got my arithmetic right.
But it's also a great sign of someone who is young who wants to step into a really challenging space. And I'm sure it's challenged you just as working in difficult spaces has challenged me over time. And we're going to have a great conversation about this little book. There's something to be said for little books. They don't take a long time to read in this very busy world that we live in, but they also give you really pithy messages. But first, Tom, I want to hear from you. Why did you want to work in the climate space in the first place? What interested you?
I first got involved in climate actually relatively late in a way. I mean, I write in the book that I had a slightly interesting upbringing insofar as I was raised on a farm in country Victoria, which was largely off-grid till I was about 16 years of age, which for someone of my generation, as Zoe so kindly puts it, is slightly unusual to say the least. And in fact, when I was 16, through the introduction of the first solar subsidies by the Howard government, our farm got regular electricity for the first time. And I think that that transformational ability on my life certainly struck me at the time, but the broader relevance of it in terms of the climate fight and the fact that it's provided such a transformative experience for so many other Australians perhaps didn't dawn on me until much later in life. I think, though, when I was in my 20s, and, you know, really it was through right time and right place, I was someone that was much more interested, actually, in foreign policy and the state of the world, and geopolitics, and that's certainly what I studied at university. But I had an extraordinary opportunity to work for the Marshall Islands government, which is one of the lowest lying countries in the entire world. I mean, it is Coral Atoll, so it means there is no higher point. The highest point on the island is a little bridge, which is about 2 meters above sea level. And there's therefore an existentiality about it, right? Particularly when you visit, which is a slither of land in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, often no wider than the road. And in fact, often the water will wash from one side of the island to the other, and you'll have this sensation literally of sinking below the waves. And I think that that brought home to me the profound existentiality of this crisis, and I've worked on it ever since. But, you know, for a lot of people, and I think a lot of people would probably resonate with this, depending on the demographics of the room, but becoming a father makes it much more acute in terms of your consideration of this, because, you know, I've got two beautiful young girls, and it's hard to sort of think, particularly as someone that works in this movement, that you are bringing them into a world, as I start the very book by saying, where we have already passed the threshold for what's considered a safe existence in terms of the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide. And you're therefore kind of, either in a way, being somewhat selfish, or in a way, taking a huge bet on the positive potential of us being able to solve this crisis in a way that will provide for them for the future. So that's kind of what got me into it, and certainly what motivates me now. But as I say, it was a pretty, in the scheme of things, it was a pretty late experience and evolution.
So you say in the book that you wrote a lot of it in the early hours of the morning after the birth of a child.
I did.
What motivated you to write this particular book? And can you just give the audience a sort of a snapshot of what you're trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, I half joke in the book that we had our second child in June last year, and in December I went on a period of paternity leave, and I somewhat stupidly thought to myself, look, I could write this book during paternity leave. I'll have oodles of time on my hands. She'll be napping. Every mother in the room can collectively moan at this point. That was a stupid idea, and I quickly realised I had no time, so the only way to write it was actually to get up hellishly early and write it before either of the kids woke up, and then go to bed with them at a very early hour that night. Why I wrote it, though, was, you know, as someone that has had the experience of really working in the upper echelons of international climate and energy diplomacy for really about 15 years now, you know, I'd had a number of experiences, including being back in Australia during the last election campaign, where it felt to me that we were in many ways becoming disconnected as a movement from actually the lived everyday concerns of particularly what I focus on in the book, which is middle Australia, which is the, you know, part of Australia that I grew up in. And what I mean by that is, you know, we often, and by that I mean, you know, people like me, and I've said a few times in talking about the book that I think I'm the number one culprit of this, we often preach from on high about the moral imperative of this transition, or the legal mandates that mean that we need to decarbonize, right? We start the conversation by talking about the Paris Agreement, or we talk about the importance of net zero, all of which is often completely detached from most people's lived reality, right? And certainly their lived reality in the middle of a cost of living crisis, which I think for most of us probably were of the view that this is going to be a rolling cost of living crisis. It certainly has been for a number of years now. So we can't sort of ride it out. We've got to be able to find a way to make sure that we are bringing the connection and experience of that transition home to roost for everyday Australians, right? So that they see acting on climate and energy as the other side of the coin to actually what makes economic sense. Now, we often talk about that, but when we talk about it, we often do it over very long time horizons. You know, something's going to make sense in 10 years' time or 50 years' time. We don't necessarily talk about it here and now. So that was point number one. Point number two was that it increasingly has dawned on me as well that a lot of our policy design in terms of acting on climate and transitioning to renewable energy is also leaving a lot of people behind. You know, we've got some really profound stories in this country, particularly around things like rooftop solar, largest penetration in the world. 4 million rooftops in Australia have rooftop solar. 1 in 10 Australians going to sleep each night under the power of the sun. What we don't really talk about, for example, is that we're leaving, you know, those people are largely people that own their own home and live in it. You know, so we are leaving behind a lot of renters in this transition. And of course, a lot of renters are often people who, not exclusively, but are often people who are are struggling a lot with the cost of living crisis and are trying to do everything in their means to bring their own energy costs down, which they can control. And often they can't control the biggest factor, which is where that power is coming from. I come from country Victoria. I live again in country Victoria now, having moved back to Australia. We are leaving a lot of people in the regions behind. We are particularly leaving behind people in the kind of industrial regions of Australia, where there's a really profound transition that we're going to have to make in terms of where our sources of prosperity come from, which I talk about in the book, and how do we actually make that feel lived and real for them as a workforce here and now.
It is a massive challenge that we have, and everyone in this room, I'm sure, has an interest in this space and probably feels quite frustrated. I know I do. And it so happens, Tom, that I saw you speak at an event a couple of weeks ago with Cristiana Figueres, who was the absolute gun diplomat who led the Paris climate negotiations. And there was a lot of learning and there was a lot of discussion around these issues. And it really bears thinking around whether we went in the wrong direction as people who wanted to execute this change based on a moral and environmental standpoint. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, we've lost a lot of people because they haven't been able to grapple with how it will benefit them, their community. We've allowed division to percolate into those communities that has been fomented by the fossil fuel industry to protect itself. Mm-hmm. We have seen Donald Trump pull out of the Paris Agreement twice, so fragmenting that process and scaffolding, if I could call it that. And we now have One Nation in this country similarly fomenting division based on the frustration of these communities who feel that no one is listening and that they're going backwards, not forwards. Mm-hmm. So we're going to try to spend some time in this conversation on the how do we fix it piece.
Great.
And I'm really curious about your thinking on that. You know, Ezra Klein in his book Abundance expresses frustration over the failure to convince people that renewable energy is a good thing. Mm-hmm. What went wrong, and in this environment of misinformation and disinformation that we live in with immensely powerful interests, are we too late to turn that narrative?
A couple of thoughts. First of all, I think that Cristiana, by the way, is an absolute legend of the climate and energy movement, but also, frankly, just in terms of her broad impact on the world, and would really recommend her own book to all of you called The Future We Choose. I think partly to paraphrase Cristiana, because I think it's a really important point. At the time the Paris Agreement was forged, right, in 2015, we were in a very different landscape, as we were, by the way, in a very different landscape from Copenhagen, which we also often focus on in this country because it was such an abject failure of climate diplomacy. But the difference between where we were in Paris and where we are now is that genuinely the economics have changed. And they had changed a lot from Copenhagen to Paris, but it was still largely a prospective argument. These days, if you are looking at a investment prospectus, you are taking a decision even around your own home, the economics of this transition, the economics of renewable energy in particular, are compelling in the short term, not just over the long term, which I think was different when we were in Paris, which is why as a movement, we also, you know, we pointed to those longitudinal benefits, but we also, as you say, Zoe, we focused intently on the moralizing and we focused intently on the science. So I think the first part is we've got to be able to demonstrate those economic benefits. But, you know, to my earlier point, we've got to be able to do that not just in the macro, but in the micro. We've got to be able to do that at a very personal level for everyone as part of this transition. I think we're up against huge forces and we're up against huge vested interests in terms of forces, which, you know, you've yourself experienced perhaps more than anyone in terms of your own lived experience, Zoe. But the challenge is a couple of fold. One is misinformation and disinformation. We have got to get better at countering. And we have got to get better at countering at its source. You know, there's one particular television network, which I won't name, given we're being recorded for the ABC, but, you know, that being broadcast into regional Australia free of charge has been a real problem, actually, for the rollout of renewable energy infrastructure, which in terms of the large scale energy infrastructure is predominantly in regional and rural Australia. That has been a particularly pervasive and negative experience. But countering that information is kind of not enough, is the view that I've formed. Doesn't mean we don't do it. And I wish as a movement that we could do it faster. We could not, you know, have an academic seminar about why intellectually there's 15 reasons that this headline in a certain newspaper is wrong. You've just got to get out there and stop the bleeding straight away. Because at the end of the day, falsehoods will spread much faster than facts. But where I've got to is I think we've also got to think about how we actually win hearts and minds. So the constituency for that misinformation and disinformation over time becomes less and less. And I think there's a real temptation in our movement, in the climate and energy movement, to actually think, well, we've won the day. You know, we've seen a pro-renewables government compared to the alternative be overwhelmingly elected at the last election. We've seen a ballot box dismissal of a very costly plan to install nuclear energy in this country, for example. So, you know, ipso facto, we're there, right? We're kind of getting there. We're over 50% renewables in the grid. I don't think so. You should never approach it in that way. But what I say earlier in terms of finding ways that we can deliver on this transition through some really practical policy ideas to spread the benefits of it here and now to people. And the book is littered, by the way, not just with some nice prose, but also with some nice practical policy ideas, is that they're the kinds of things that whether someone is skeptical of renewables, whether they think it's a massive Chinese conspiracy, whether they think the world is flat or whether they think the world is round, it doesn't matter. Because hopefully seeing is believing, and over time they will take decisions which are in their own economic self-interest, including maybe, for example, installing renewables on their roof or improving the energy efficiency of their home or dampening the risk of a catastrophic weather event hurting their own household. And that will prove to them that this transition is actually beneficial, irrespective of how much of that misinformation and disinformation takes root. So I think you've got to do both.
From the Smart Energy Council, Tom Woodruff writes in his new book, Power, Prosperity and Planet, Climate and Energy Policy for All, these words: the fact is, Australia needs a climate and energy policy that works for everyone, from the cabinet room to the boardroom, to every lounge room across the mortgage belts, in the regions and beyond. Good climate and energy policy should cost people less each month, not more. And this former climate negotiator joins you on Big Ideas today on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen with me, Natasha Mitchell. Asking the questions is former federal independent MP and former ABC journalist Zoe Daniel.
So I think one of the issues that we have is the power and the money. And as Tom alluded to, large third-party organisations like Advance and Australians for Prosperity that are operating currently in Australia are at least partly funded by the fossil fuel sector. So big coal, big gas and others. And so in the case of the seat of Goldstein, arguably that had an influence on the outcome of the seat because they're able to pay for advertising. But also beyond elections, there is the way that social media operates, where you have an enormous amount of money feeding the algorithm to a particular kind of person to make them believe a particular thing. And one thing that I'm interested in is what your view is of the success or failure of the renewable energy industry and also their responsibility to step into this a little more overtly. I mean, if you drive to the airport in Canberra, and I do that a lot even now, there's massive billboards as you drive up saying how fantastic gas is for the Australian economy. Why is that not renewable energy advertising? I mean, there are some obvious ways to step into it, and I have to be blunt, I don't think the industry stepped in hard enough. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
Couldn't agree more. I had the same experience going to Canberra Airport on Friday night, where I think the billboard says this is how much gas has contributed to the economy. It's crying out for someone to spray paint how much we've missed out on as an economy as well, by the way.
We do not condone vandalism.
Here's where I think as a movement we could do better. if you look at the fossil fuels sector in this country, yeah, they've got bucket loads of cash for sure. They're also just really well organised, and they're really well organised under an umbrella body. If you look at the, and there's multiple parts of this transition, it's not just renewable energy in Australia, but if you look at the renewable energy ecosystem in Australia, there's 3, 4, 5 peak bodies, for example, all with basically the same name and are perpetually confused amongst one another. I work for one of them, by the way. Mm-hmm. And that's actually, in my view, just not doing things smart. You are dividing rather than conquering when you should be conquering. So we need to be much better, I think, at doing that. We spend too much time looking at what everyone else is doing and thinking about how we can compete for funding for a particular project or compete for members or whatever it may be, rather than actually pooling our resources in a collective interest. The same is also the case, though, I think, just beyond the renewable energy sector, right? You know, we have a pretty disaggregated movement writ large, if I'm thinking about the broad ecosystem of everyone working on climate and energy. And I think we are missing that organising principle. I think to your other point, Zoe, like we also need to understand how we can just be more agile, how we can respond with a kind of 21st century playbook often on this stuff, including things like taking out billboards and whatever else. I think some of that does happen, by the way. I mean, there's a particular group in Australia that I think is quite good at this. And, you know, I know for a fact that when we were looking at hosting COP31 in Australia, before it was known where it would be if it was in Australia, this group had taken out all of the billboard packages at the Sydney Convention Centre for November 2026, right? Which would have been really, really smart. But I think we've got to be, you know, better as a whole at understanding how we can use the campaign tactics that have been wielded so effectively against us in this transition right back at them.
Hard agree. And look, it seems obvious to me that when you have a group of organisations seeking a similar outcome competing against each other so that their brand is elevated, that you're going to end up with counterproductive outcomes. I do wonder too, though, whether part of the issue is around the timeframes. Christiana said, everyone who works in the climate space has swallowed an alarm clock. And that really resonated with me. Everyone's panicking and we don't have time. We've got to get it done now. But the thing is, if you look at, you know, large-scale industrial change or any sort of large-scale change over history, you have ebbs and flows in the one step forward, two step back sort of process of that change. Mm. The issue with climate is we all feel that we can't afford that we can't stop to actually think, how should we re-strategise what we're doing? And, you know, I want to put something else to you as well, which is that I think as activists in this space, we've gone straight into battle head on, whereas the opportunity now is to build the fight from underneath, mm-hmm. from within communities. And, mm-hmm. and that's where I come from within the community independence movement. Do you see opportunities to actually work more hand in hand with communities to execute the transition for everyone, not only so that people see benefit from a narrative point of view, but are actually part of and within the process?
Yeah, I think the other great revelation that I've had along the way is vast swathes of Australia are doing everything they can as part of this transition, right? And you know, I spoke about it at an event I was at with you, Zoe, a couple of weeks ago, but this was really brought home to me by someone who said to me at the time that they had got solar on their roof, they'd installed a battery. They wanted to install a battery, and as a result, given they were still connected to the grid, despite electrifying their heat pump, hadn't yet electrified their stovetop, had a hybrid, couldn't afford an EV, but was crawling into bed at night to save money on the power that they were getting from the grid. And I thought, wow, that's a really great demonstration of how so many people are doing everything they can to embrace this transformation when it can stack up economically for them. And I feel like that's a story right around the country, right? Like people are eager in a way to do this, or we need to demonstrate the benefits to them. And we need to find a way to unleash that. Now, at the same time, I think also for a lot of people, they are taking that decision not because they are climate and energy zealots, but because, as I say, it just makes sense for them. So I think as a movement, we've got to be careful not to, weaponize every aspect of this transition. It's about meeting people where they are and helping give them the tools and the information, the resources, and hopefully the policy design that allows them to take the next step in that journey, right? Whether it be making EVs more accessible, which I talk about in the book, whether it be making solar more accessible to renters, which I talk about in the book, whether it be helping them get insurance where a lot of Australia has lost insurance, which I talk about in the book. These are the kind of things that we need to be able to unlock. Now, though, I think there's a community dimension to that, which is, you know, often the most, I reckon, one of the most positive things that's actually happened in Australia's transformation at a household level in this country has been because of that rooftop solar penetration. You see your neighbour get it, right? Now, your neighbour is probably going to be much more able to convince you to get it than your local federal member or someone working in the sector, right? And that's where community conversations can really happen. And there's some great community work happening around even collective projects, right? Like community battery programs in Country Victoria. There's examples of community energy projects. You know, there's a very famous wind farm, for example, in Hepburn, which is near where I went to school. So it's about also making sure that our policy design is enabling those communities to take charge and to do as much as they can to convince their fellow citizens and not just us constantly talking to the household as well.
Yeah, so one of the cool things about the book is that as someone who reads a lot of policy and has developed policy, there is actual policy in the book and there are policy suggestions in the book. I think it's interesting what you've just described because I've seen exactly that as a community independent where you create safety for people by creating community around something. So very much in my campaigns, it was a case of, well, the more people put on a T-shirt, the more people will put on a T-shirt. The more people put up a sign, the more people will put up a sign. You're much more likely to put up a sign if your neighbour has a sign. Mm-hmm. It creates safety in streets, in towns, in communities. The barrier, I think, to that, or one of them in Australia, is that politicians don't seem to be able to agree on anything. There is very little collaboration. It is almost entirely combative, other than, you know, my dear friends on the crossbench who try their best to bring people together. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at what point do you think that the economic arguments around this will start to flatten that debate out? I mean, even what we've seen with the Iran war, with people adopting EVs all of a sudden, because there's an economic reason to do that. So it starts to sort of kill off the EVs are going to end the weekend conversation because people see that it's the best option for them as a family.
Yeah. Two thoughts. One is, I think as part of this current crisis, Australian households have really demonstrated, as they so often do, that they are one step ahead of governments, right? So many households have got to the point of, there's a fossil fuels crisis going on. We need to do everything we can to get off fossil fuels as a household, right? So let's get that EV, even if there's a three-month wait list, dare I say. And, you know, the thing I think that is really wanting at the moment is that as a country, we still need to, I think, be able to really turn a page from being utterly focused on the securing of supply and doing things like building more petroleum diesel reserves in this country to actually telling the narrative around or building the narrative around what does a truly resilient Australia look like and never wasting a good crisis, right, in terms of doing that. And I don't think we've yet done that as a country. The second point I was going to make, which has just escaped me.
I was going to go to the broader issue of political collaboration. And, you know, you've worked in politics. You worked for Kevin Rudd.
Yeah.
I mean, arguably, we're getting more and more polarised, not less.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I barely saw Labor and the Liberal National Coalition collaborate on anything, let alone a potential Liberal National One Nation Coalition, which is the slippery slide we're currently on.
Yeah.
Where will the common ground be between those two?
Yeah, so I've got a slight hypothesis on this, which is, and let me start by saying, well, I mean, I think the answer in part, not in whole to your question, is when there's a growing and almost at times silent constituency which begins to build or begins to change in terms of how they are approaching this, which again is goes to my point around you can't just counter this, you can't just preach it, you've actually got to bring these people with you and meet them here and now. And let me give you an example of that. All of you are here on a Wednesday night, which means that religiously on a Sunday morning you're watching Insiders. So about 4 or 5 or 6 weeks ago, Andrew Hastie did Insiders, right? And he was asked about the government's cheaper home battery program, which is a phenomenal program. It's been hugely successful. 400,000 Australian households since last July have now installed a battery. About a quarter of those, by the way, have also installed solar for the first time. And because everyone's buying the biggest battery they can, which is my investment advice to all of you, while the rebate exists, a lot of them are also upgrading their solar panels at the same time. Because if they're people like my parents who have got an abysmally small 990 watts of solar, any battery is going to be too big for that unit. But the point is, he was asked about this program. And basically in every electorate around the country, there's pretty close now to 3,000 households that have embraced this program. And he, in the space of about 60 seconds, attempted and then failed to confect a conspiracy theory about this program, right? And there's, you know, there was no evidence, there was no suggestion of any impropriety other than this is something that they are worried about and will take a look at. Now, my point is this, if that many people in those electorates begin to take up these kind of programs, and I do think there are limitations to that program, not least the one I mentioned earlier, which is it benefits people that own their own home. It doesn't benefit renters. And as we know, that people that are, you know, already feeling generationally locked out of the housing market are compounded in ways, that frustration is compounded in ways like this. I'll say that as someone that's only ever been a renter in my whole life. But if there is a growing constituency that just shift in terms of their embrace of this transformation, irrespective of their ideological disposition, you would think that that has a cooling effect in the Conservative Party rooms of this country in terms of whether they do things like take a program like that to the chopping board or fail to do anything in favour of the continued rollout of renewable energy if they were to form office, or indeed to block legislation as it might be seeking to go through the parliaments of Australia today. So I think that that's part of how we do it. Look, I wish we had much more bipartisanship on this issue in this country. I mean, part of the point I make in the book is that the first election I voted in was 2007, and really since 2007 we've been on a journey in this country of having now almost two decades of climate wars. We can all aspire to that, and I hope that we get to that, and I think probably the currents are trending, you would think, more positively towards that as we start to just notch up things like having a majority of power running through our grid as renewables, a majority of households embracing renewables and all the rest of it. But in the meantime, we've got to think about how to reach people who may not already be of the faith, whether in terms of renewable energy or in terms of their ideological disposition.
Making the energy transition work for everyone is what Tom Woodruff explores in his new book, Power, Prosperity and Planet, Climate and Energy Policy for All. He is a senior international fellow with the Smart Energy Council and played a key negotiating role in the 2015 Paris Agreement on climate change. He is your big thinker today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. G'day, I'm Natasha Mitchell. A recalibration of sorts today for climate and energy politics with host former independent MP for the Melbourne seat of Goldstein and former ABC journalist Zoe Daniel.
I want to take you back to Paris because it's a little bit my two steps forward, one back piece. And I think it's sometimes important to remind ourselves of really significant moments in history, and that was one. And you talked about the Marshall Islands briefly at the start of this conversation. There was a really cool moment that you recount in the book around the Pacific leaders and what happened in Paris. And to me, it said everything about the stubborn optimism that Christiana Figueres says that we all need to sustain, even though we feel like we're backsliding. Can you just paint that anecdote for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a great lesson in there as well, which probably you felt in your political period as well, Zoe, about sometimes you've got a stake, a mast in the ground, and people will come to you as well, which is not so much about bipartisanship and reaching out as important part of the process that is, but actually creating something that is so attractive that people want to be on board. That the anecdote is, as I said, I worked for the Marshall Islands, and the Marshall Islands, through a number of things, but most importantly, I think, through very charismatic, powerful leadership in their president and their foreign minister, who I worked directly for. I spent 6 months living in the Marshall Islands, used to visit several times a year. In the period leading up to Paris, they began to take on a really profound role. One, because they had such a point of moral leadership on this crisis, right? You know, they were the demonstrable canary in the coal mine, to overuse an anecdote that too often people would say. But second of all, they had some really practical policy suggestions that they were putting forward into the negotiating process. So, by the way, and a whole range of things that we all take for granted these days, the fact that every country in the world, including Australia, sets their target every 5 years was a Marshall Islands proposal to begin with. The fact that we have a kind of global long-term goal, which now manifests as net zero, that was a Marshall Islands proposal. The one I often like to talk about, by the way, is also there's a scientific consensus now effectively that 1.5 degrees of average global warming above pre-industrial levels is the sort of safe limit. It played a very big role in the last democratic the last democratic primary, because there wasn't a primary last time, in terms of being a market point in the debate in the United States. But the whole reason that that existed is because in the Paris text, there was a mandate for there to be a scientific investigation of the merits of 1.5 degrees. That was inserted into the text by us at like 3 o'clock in the morning when it was 170 pages long, the worst track change document you'd ever seen. And we thought, wouldn't it be great to have three or four things in there as negotiating fodder that we can, when things inevitably start getting gutted, we can say, well, you can take two and three, but we want to keep one. And miraculously, it survived and kickstarted this whole scientific process. But the point was, using that moral leadership, using those policy interventions, we started gathering in secret a bunch of progressive climate ministers from around the world in secret for about 6 or 8 months before Paris, in various places where they already were beginning to chat about that process. And about halfway through those Paris talks, which were a grueling 3 weeks in an old, effectively abandoned airport in the sort of inner outskirts of Paris, there was a real moment where it felt existential. It was a terrible negotiating night. There were minister after minister from laggard countries doing everything possible to bring that process down. It felt very Copenhagen-esque. John Kerry was very powerfully in the room at 3 o'clock in the morning, arguing all kinds of powerful interventions. But it felt like a moment where actually the energy and the momentum had shifted and we were on track for a real disaster. So we took the decision the next day to leak strategically the existence of this coalition to the media. And in the rarefied world of a UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, COP, where you've got 60,000 people in these aircraft hangars in Paris, including probably 1,000 journalists, it's like catnip. Right? There's just nothing that can quite explain it. It's probably like a sort of Parliament House media scrum on steroids. And we couldn't go anywhere because there were hundreds of journalists camped outside every little office that we were trying to go between. But it actually had a really powerful effect. First of all, it really emboldened the countries that were part of it, because they were loving the fact that they felt this responsibility on their shoulders and that everyone was kind of looking to them. It meant that every other country in the world that had a court of public opinion was desperate to hear that their country had joined this high ambition coalition, which was just a name, by the way, that we cooked up in the middle of the night, didn't have a name. So much so that the Australian Foreign Minister at the time, Julie Bishop, was almost singularly focused, it felt, dare I say it, on making sure that Australia was part of this high ambition coalition, which, footnote, they never were. And just as we got into the final hours of Paris, I think after about two nights of basically no one having slept, you never quite know how these final plenaries go. And they are really, I mean, everyone studies diplomacy and you kind of learn that everything happens for a reason, it's full of protocol. Diplomacy is not like that. It's a game of theatre, particularly multilateral diplomacy. So no one knew how it was going to go. So the ministers were meeting and they were all saying, you know, we'll back each other on the floor if the text gets opened up and all sorts of things. But I said to the Marshall Islands Foreign Minister, I said, why don't you link arms and march to the final plenary? Because there's about 100 journalists parked outside this room right now. And to their credit, they did, which was a very activist thing for like 30 or 40 ministers of countries to do, right? So much so that the UN security freaked out because they thought it was literally a protest and wouldn't let these 30 or 40 ministers into the final plenary. But it had an effect, which is when they walked in, the momentum in that room was palpable in how it shifted in support of them and their mission, which was a progressive mission. But I think the lesson for everyone is sometimes putting a stake in the ground is really important because it means that people will also come to you. They will, you know, it will have a resonating focus.
Yes, and dare I say, I think you've just described your umbrella and the power of everyone linking arms and moving forward cohesively to create collective change. I would love to take some questions from the floor. Just before I go to questions, I just wanted to finish on the matter of young people and optimism. Mm. And a little story that I was telling at the climate meeting that I was at with Christiana, where a lot of the climate activists who were there were expressing the fact that they've lost optimism and that maybe they will choose not to have children if they're a younger person. And a lot of people around them are choosing not to have children. And I have a 17-year-old and a 19-year-old. And it so happens that we've been to Costa Rica, which is where Christiana Figueres is from. And when we went, my children were a lot younger. They were primary school age and they were really keen to do a very long hike through one of the most biodiverse jungles in the world. So we did a couple of days hike through the heat, through this jungle with the kids. And one thing that shocked me was the amount of plastic that was on the beaches in this extraordinarily pristine area. But on the optimistic side, all of the mindful walkers who walk through this area pick up all the rubbish and pile it up on the beaches. And then the Costa Rican government sends barges in to pick it up. And it's just another form of collective action that by picking up every bottle top that's washing in onto the beach in that remote part of Costa Rica and putting on it on a pile, you're actually participating in collective change. And I was telling the members of the group on the retreat that my children became little activists out of that experience. And I think that we have to place some trust in our young people that are even younger than you, Tom, that they will continue to link arms and push through this. All right, questions. Let's go to the floor.
Hi, Mary Lou Cork. I found it really interesting that you said, Zoe, earlier, don't waste a moral crisis. And I'm going to use the parallel of COVID and how participation rates have increased, especially for women working from home, and now we have low unemployment rates. Looking at this, there's been a lot of debate around the fact that we're not reaching people because often, you know, when we're trying to pitch to people, we're doing it on a moral ground or a scientific ground. Morality is dependent upon your paradigm and science can be refuted. I mean, take a look at Trump. He doesn't believe any of the science. Yeah. So looking to government in terms of policy, I will use the example of Easter Sunday when people were queuing up for 5 hours to charge their EV vehicles. There's been a surge in EV interest in May, particularly I think more than 40% have increased. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that as a person, say for instance, looking at EV, where do I charge it? How long is it going to take me? And so that's where I reckon that when it comes to like these cost of living costs and challenges where people are just surviving, they don't have the mental bandwidth to talk about morality and science. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to put food on the table. So I wondered, is there an opportunity for government to basically, you know, take leadership and perhaps like when we were talking about housing and the fact that we're trying to increase housing, why don't they put batteries in? Because obviously those people are people that are, you know, receiving government benefits for you know, government housing. That will then amplify each dollar that they receive. Mm. And so that's what we're asking is like, what infrastructure and what real dollars is there in order to basically, you know, incentivize people economically towards that? So it's not from a morality or a scientific, but it's the fact that, you know, the everyday Australian just wants to try and put more food on the table or to look after kids or to pay the mortgage.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, do you think that there's an opportunity there for bipartisan agreement around, you know, building infrastructure and having forward leadership around those things?
Thank you. Thank you for the question.
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, on COVID, couldn't agree with you more. I think actually we did miss an opportunity when it comes to this transition. I mean, people might remember the catchphrase at the time was build back better. I think it's hard to feel like collectively we did. On EV policy specifically, boy, have I got a good book for you. There's three particular ideas that I talk about in terms of EVs. And you're absolutely right. They're selling like crackers at the moment. 70,000 last month, up 40%. On the month before. But I think that there's three things. One is we've got to do more to actually make EVs more accessible. They are still actually quite expensive compared to combustible engine vehicles in this country. One way I think that we could do that is, for example, having better lenders who are taking into account how much you will save by way of both, not just fuel, by the way, but also maintenance. I mean, there's literally like six moving parts in the drive shaft of an EV compared to on average 250 in a petrol vehicle. That would help make them more accessible, particularly if those payment rates were less than you would otherwise take on a cheaper combustible vehicle. Second of all, I think we've got to find a way to solve the battery issue. And what I mean by that is a lot of people worry about, and indeed a lot of battery, a lot of warranties for batteries in EVs don't transfer from owner to owner. So effectively in this country, if you want to buy an EV, overwhelmingly people are buying new vehicles. And if you're from middle Australia, it's very rare in your entire life that you've probably ever bought a new vehicle. You are buying a secondhand vehicle. And with an EV, with a used battery without a warranty, you're therefore taking a huge risk. So government could underwrite that certification. And the third is just infrastructure, right? To your point. I mean, in country Victoria, it's kind of abysmal. And I've recently moved from a country called Norway where 95% of new cars sold are EVs. There are EV chargers everywhere. We just don't have that in this country. We have it a little bit in the city, but even then, frankly, it's pretty poor. We need to do things like have better building codes for garages under apartment blocks that take into account lithium fire protections. We need to spend more than, dare I say it, $40 million in last week's budget on enhanced EV infrastructure rollout in this country if we've got 70,000 people buying EVs. But we need to be able to put those chargers where people are actually spending their time, right? At supermarket car parks, in hospital car parks, at sporting grounds while you're watching your kids run around. That's how we can do that rollout better, because the problem we'll have otherwise is lots of people will buy EVs and the infrastructure just won't keep up.
We might have time for two more questions, but we'll try for one. Do I have another question? Yep, at the back.
Hello. In your excellent book, Tom, you do flag that we're shifting into a disinformation age, sort of from the information age, and that creates an extra set of challenges to go through reform. Could you comment on that?
Well, I think it's really what I touched on before, which is that we've got to be mindful, I think, that we've got to counter misinformation and disinformation, and we've got to be able to counter it quickly. We can't have an academic seminar about all the reasons that that something's wrong. We've just got to be able to cut it off. We've got to be able to find a way to tell the real story. You know, there's a number of very pervasive myths in this country, which are disinformation and misinformation fueled to do with this transition. You know, one of the biggest, I think, is that, you know, the South Australian blackout of a number of years ago was caused by renewables when in fact it wasn't. You know, another, by the way, kind of relatedly, but not just on renewable energy here, is that China's not doing a thing. You know, yeah, it's true that China's installing a hell of a lot of and planning to build a hell of a lot of coal-fired power stations, but they're also installing more solar in a week than we do in a year. Let that sink in. You know, that we're just talking about a sheer scale here. So we've got to be able to tell those stories over time. But I think also we've just got to be able to try and find a way to actually allow the people that are being brought into that disinformation and misinformation to over time understand through seeing is believing that this transition is so much more beneficial to them than often they may believe.
One more question.
Thank you. I'm from country Victoria as well, so that's fantastic. And I just want to ask about like the harder problems, like transmission lines, for example, are quite contentious.
Yeah.
But also there's other problems like water policy and sea level rise.
Yeah.
I guess I was thinking like transmission policy isn't as cool of a story as EVs are, I guess.
Yeah.
And I was curious if the solutions are more like hardcore policy solutions, or if there can be those opportunities for those sorts of storytelling opportunities to get regional Australia over the line, because that we're kind of at that hard stage of the transition.
Yeah.
So keen for your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that the way that this rollout has happened has been unfortunate because it has made it harder to grow that constituency in parts of regional Australia. And by that, I mean exactly what you point to, right? Which is that transmission lines are being installed. There are, you know, constantly road closures associated with that. Oh, and by the way, regional Australia has the highest rates of electricity off the grid, even though they're housing the overwhelming majority of the large-scale renewable energy infrastructure in this country, right? So it just rubs salt into a wound that often exists, or we've allowed to exist and not found a way to cauterize. I think that the solution, or one of the solutions, and one I talk about in the book, is, for example, things like recognizing that disparity through things like a sense of the rate idea, where if you're from a regional part of Australia, the electricity providers would be mandated to provide you a cheaper rate on your electricity, in fact, because of the fact that they are installing this infrastructure in that area. And that would provide people, provide communities, as Zoe spoke so passionately about tonight, would provide them a real demonstrable benefit for, in fact, housing that. And I think that would start to change some of the perceptions as well.
Tom, do you remain optimistic for your two little kids?
I do. Yeah. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One is, for me at least, I've got nothing but optimism to focus on, given that, our two young daughters will inherit this world. The second, though, is, you know, having worked for the most vulnerable country in the world, it's pretty easy sometimes to fall into the trap of doom and gloom, and they don't fall into that trap. And that has always been kind of profoundly extraordinary to me. You know, if you are literally at that level of existentiality, at least about your land, there's a whole bunch of legal questions around what then happens. But and you are already feeling those impacts very acutely in that kind of place. But you are still optimistic, and you are still putting policy ideas on the table, driving the global agenda. I think it's incumbent on everyone from countries like ourselves to be optimists as well.
Thanks for coming, everyone. Please thank Tom.
With his stake firmly in the ground, Tom Woodruff, Senior International Fellow with the Smart Energy Council, former climate negotiator and advisor to former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. His new essay for Monash University Publishing's In the National Interest series is called Power, Prosperity and Planet, Climate and Energy Policy for All. It's a great little series of books worth getting your hands on. And he was joined there in conversation with host Zoe Daniel, former community-backed independent MP for Goldstein, and former ABC journalist and foreign correspondent. Thanks to Readings Bookshop for that conversation. Hey, next on Big Ideas, another former politician, a former Prime Minister, in fact, Tony Abbott. He's got a book out. It's about Australian history. And so too does Mark McKenna. Now, they're very different historians. So what happens when you put them on a stage together? You can find out in our next episode. Big Ideas is produced by Claire Slattery, Karin Zivanovits, and me, your host, Natasha Mitchell. Thanks to sound engineer David LeMay and the ABC engineers all over the country who record these events for you, and us, Marcus Hobbs, captured today's event. And I'll catch you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.